Now, we've covered carrier design in general, and US carriers in particular, in various Wednesday videos on the channel. But this time, thanks to the fine folk over on Patreon who voted for this particular subject, we're going to look at the US Navy's Fleet Carrier Development Program from its inception to the point when they could let go of treaty restrictions, by looking primarily at the options that they had on the table and didn't choose, and why they didn't choose these, and instead obviously go with the designs that we do know about and have covered elsewhere. So, winding the clock all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century, although there had been various early experiments with launching aircraft from various ships in the US Navy during the 1900s, that is the first decade of the 20th century, followed by the 1910s, it seems that the service's interest in carriers specifically stemmed from when US Navy officers were serving aboard various Royal Navy ships after the US joined World War I towards the end of that conflict. During this period, the US officers were able to observe the myriad ways that the British had developed to launch aircraft at sea, some considerably better than others. One of the main points that showed up in many reports was that wheeled aircraft of the late 1910s were far superior to float planes, even when the aircraft was identical except for the type of landing gear they had. And with the technology of the time, most float planes had to be both launched and recovered from the sea, which meant that the ship in question, if it wanted to deploy its aircraft, had to slow down. And often in the North Sea, the waves meant that even if it did so, it just wasn't possible to operate float planes a lot of the time. And even if the float plane did get into the air, the weight and drag of the floats obviously made them inferior in performance compared to their wheeled counterparts. And as well as the performance edge, wheeled aircraft could of course be launched from small platforms without a ship having to slow down. On battleships, where these platforms could be mounted on top of gun turrets that could then be turned into the wind, it wasn't even necessary to change course. And of course, in so doing, you could operate a wheeled aircraft in a much wider range of weather conditions. The only problem this faced was recovering those aircraft. Wheeled aircraft that ditched were lost, and so some form of landing deck was required unless you wanted a very extensive bill in lost aircraft and the occasional drowned pilot. And that meant a dedicated aircraft carrier. This lesson was further reinforced when British naval architect Stanley Goodall arrived in the United States with a large number of plans in his suitcase. Although the visit is often known for his sharing of the plans of HMS Hood and the effect that this had on US Navy battlecruiser design programs, he also brought over preliminary plans for HMS Hermes, the Royal Navy's first purpose-built aircraft carrier, which was in the middle of being designed at the time. Given the relatively short-range nature of aircraft of the period, Goodall advocated for follow-on carriers to have a decent surface battery, he suggested 6-inch guns, as well as torpedo tubes. This, he said, would allow a carrier to brush aside smaller enemy craft, like destroyers that might be part of a fleet screen and get in its way, and the torpedoes would allow it to threaten larger ships like battleships, cruisers, and battlecruisers, at least long enough for it to escape. He also wanted future carriers to be armoured like a small cruiser, which would guard them against destroyer gunfire as well as the secondary batteries of larger ships, and to have a top speed of somewhere between 30 and 35 knots. His actual criteria was whatever speed the fleet scouting forces would be expected to operate at, as he envisaged a carrier as a ship that would operate with those vessels. Apart from the torpedo tubes, those familiar with US Navy fleet carrier design that as actually built in the first half of the 20th century already, might recognise quite a number of recurring features in those particular design specifications, even if the exact role that Goodall envisaged for a carrier tended to evolve away from true frontline duty as aircraft ranges improved. By 1920, the US Navy was fully on board with the carrier idea, calling for the construction of 4 aircraft carriers as a priority. But unlike the Royal Navy, the US Navy had no fleet of experimental aircraft-carrying vessels to play with, and so to try and work out how effective these ships would really be, they had to resort to simulated war games. In these, although they found that aircraft never quite dominated the battlefields in and of themselves, the growing US Navy obsession with extremely long-range gunfire meant that they assessed carriers as still hugely important, initially simply because the side that gained air superiority could then operate scouting and spotting aircraft at will and deny the enemy the same courtesy. And a spotting aircraft was considered vital for any kind of gunfire at ranges above 20,000 yards. Ironically, given that the help that the Royal Navy had provided in kickstarting the US Navy's interest in carriers, these war games noted that this particular capability of aircraft carriers was especially useful in a hypothetical war against the Royal Navy, since they acknowledged that the British battle line was faster than the US Navy's line, and so, assuming that the British also adopted a similar policy of long-range gunfire, a British line would simply be able to use its speed to sit beyond the Americans' ability to reply and plink away at them with heavy guns at will if they could also gain air superiority, which would require carriers. And thus, the shape of the first purpose-designed US Navy carrier began to take form. Armed with 4 8-inch guns, half a dozen 6-inch guns, a pair of twin torpedo tubes, and some anti-aircraft weapons, it would be capable of 35 knots, because that's what the modern US Navy fleet screen was also due to be capable of, and it would carry 2 dozen fighter-reconnaissance aircraft, along with half a dozen heavier bomber aircraft. Now, you might think, that sounds like a pretty small air group for a ship that is clearly of some considerable size, and you'd be right. The air group size was partially explained by the idea that the ship was also expected to be a recovery service, maintenance service, and eventual return to sender service for the dozen or more recon and scout aircraft that would, it was thought, also be launched from various other ships, like cruisers and battlecruisers, which could then be fitted with wheels instead of floats, giving them better performance. So essentially, half the carrier's air group wasn't actually on the ship. This vessel was based around an early 35,000-ton version of the Lexington-class hull, and it would have 2 islands, one on each side, a little bit like some early British ideas for HMS Eagle. However, the US presidential election of 1920 switched around the governing parties, and suddenly the US Navy was struggling to get funding for the projects it already had underway, and it was almost impossible to start anything new. The outcome of this was a tiny amount of funding being released to convert the Collier USS Jupiter into the US Navy's first aircraft carrier instead, now dubbed USS Langley. That particular hull had been selected for a number of reasons. It was turboelectric powered, indeed it was the first US Navy turboelectric powered vessel still in service, and thus it could steam at full power in either direction, which was thought to be quite important in the event of an accident or damage occurring near the front end of the ship, allowing it to continue flight operations. It also already had large holds, large hatches, and high-load cranes all present, which would minimise conversion costs. The turboelectric drive was also useful in another respect, and that was that the US Navy anticipated all future carriers using the drive, so you might as well have continuity across the fleet. But it was far from a perfect solution. Whether as Jupiter or Langley, the ship was slow, and it had to store its aircraft disassembled in some of the cargo holds. When they were needed, you had to crane them up in various bits and pieces to what could loosely be called an open hangar deck, which was essentially the former upper deck of the ship, just now surrounded by some support beams which held up the flight deck. The aircraft would then be reassembled there, then craned onto an elevator, which didn't make it all the way down to the upper deck, and the elevator would then take the aircraft up to the flight deck where it could be used. But Langley was still useful, and with the flight deck being built high enough to simply be fitted above most of the existing bridge superstructure, it didn't take long before some aircraft were just being near permanently stored in a deck park to avoid the faff of having to get them all the way back into the cargo holds. Although in this case Langley was flush decked, there were issues with smoke dispersal, which meant that among many refits, she ended up having a pair of small hinged funnels installed, a feature that would later reappear on USS Ranger. This would have significant influence in later arguments over whether the Lexingtons should be flush decked or not, but obviously those particular details are more suited to a discussion of the Lexington design process. Now, trying to work carriers into the fleet despite a reluctant Congress also saw another idea floated, and this was to convert a couple of the Omaha-class cruisers into small carriers, since the class was coming under fire from some for being large, expensive, and somewhat underarmed. To solve the much greater issues of smoke from the considerably more powerful machinery plant on these ships, all sorts of ideas were proposed. The initial design, being flush-decked, meant that the ideas included side vents, pivoting funnels, and even a water jet system which it was thought would cool the smoke so that it wouldn't rise and would instead just flow out onto the sea, as well as just extending the funnels out on big sponsons far away from the flight deck. Unlike Langley, this hypothetical ship would have all the structures above the upper deck stripped away, and this meant it could have a true hangar, which would then yield an air group of somewhere between 24 depending on the size of the aircraft used and exactly how big the hangar actually ended up being, as it was thought some additional structure might have to be built up for accommodation and spares and so forth. But since the Omahas, whatever their faults as surface ships, were the only modern cruisers the US Navy was actually building at the time, there was considerable internal pushback against this idea, with arguments going back and forth over whether it was better to have a few smaller carriers earlier or to keep pressing for larger, more capable carriers, even if it would take much longer to get them into service, as well as people pointing out that the US Navy could scarcely afford to sacrifice a couple of its new scout cruisers, which would be needed for screening the fleet. Eventually, the proponents of the full-sized fleet carrier won out, and the idea of converting some of the Omahas would be dropped. And so it was back to designing a large fleet carrier. Quite a range of speeds and sizes were considered, but then a demand came through that whatever the carrier ended up looking like, it should have no less than 24 guns on the ship, two-thirds of them 6-inch anti-surface guns and one-third of them 5-inch anti-aircraft guns. It was quickly noted that such an armament would put huge constraints on the ability of the carrier to actually do its job of operating aircraft around what was essentially 2 to 3 cruisers worth of guns, and eventually it was agreed that the anti-aircraft role might be able to be fulfilled by the ship's fighters, and thus only 16 6-inch guns were required, although it was noted that some of these guns might be replaced with 5-inch anti-aircraft guns. But overall, at least this number of barrels had been taken down. There was a planned air group of 72 aircraft, plus quite a few more disassembled in storage, and luckily for most people, a plan to install considerable torpedo armament on the ship was also dropped pretty quickly. This vessel would, depending on the sketch design, either have an island on the starboard side or a flush deck, as I said, depending on the variant. It would also have an enclosed hangar, and finally, it would have a displacement of 39,000 tonnes once other options had been discarded. Although, after some revision, the 16 6-inch gun armament was altered to 3 twin 6-inch guns, a dozen single 5-inch guns, and 6 above-water torpedo tubes, as these made a return, all of which were facing aft in an apparent attempt to discourage pursuit. Other sketch designs leading towards this had looked at a flush deck instead of an island, and a variety of speeds, all on pretty much lower displacements. But with the call for the conference that would eventually result in the Washington Naval Treaty, it was also pretty clear that the Lexingtons themselves might now be on the chopping block. And given that this draft purpose-built carrier was so close to the Lexington size that some had already proposed using the hull plans of the Lexingtons as a basis for the ship as a cost-saving measure, it was somewhat unsurprising that efforts soon pivoted from designing and building a brand new carrier to the conversion of one or more of the battlecruisers into carriers in an effort to save at least some of the resources the US Navy had poured into the hulls. Compared to the purpose-built plans, which, as we said, were near enough the same in size at this point, the battlecruiser hulls had finer lines aft, This would restrict hangar space by approximately 16% compared to a similar length purpose-built design. There were also some worries about how these lines might affect airflow coming off the ship into the approach path of landing aircraft, and the machinery space layout meant that more extensive trunking would be needed to get the funnels over to one side. As using the more complete vessels would be cheaper, since money had already been spent on their hulls and machinery in previous years, with the Washington Naval Treaty cancelling all six Lexingtons, it meant that, after some shenanigans around exactly how you classified their displacement, Lexington and Saratoga, the two most advanced in construction, were selected for conversion. Interestingly enough, though, the least progressed Lexington-class carrier was, at the time, listed to be called USS Ranger. Once the Lexington and Saratoga had been taken in for conversion, attention now turned to how to make best use of the remaining allocated carrier tonnage, which had been provided under the treaty system. However, the lag between the choice being made for the conversion of the Lexingtons and actually getting them in service, a span of time which would last most of the 1920s, meant that the choices around what to do for the next carrier, which would now be the first purpose-built vessel to actually see service in the US Navy, would have to be guided almost entirely by tabletop war games and a bit of feedback from early fleet problems, where Langley did her level best to cosplay as either Lexington or Saratoga. There were some limitations to this way of thinking, though. Although the big carriers were being built with islands, in part because there was no other real way of getting rid of the phenomenal amount of smoke that their boilers output, and the islands essentially being built around the massive stacks, tabletop exercises couldn't analyse their efficiency in helping to command either the ship or the air group, and with Langley being a flush decker, she offered no new insights either. This would directly affect the final outcome of the studies that eventually led up to USS Ranger, the actual carrier. It all started in 1922 with a discussion of the displacement of future carriers. The US Navy had 69,000 tons of carriers left in its treaty allocation, and unlike the Imperial Japanese Navy, the US Navy had quickly decided that carriers of 10,000 tons or less, although strictly speaking unregulated by treaty, were not all that useful for the fleet. And at the upper end, there was a limit of 27,000 tons per carrier built into the treaty. Since the US Navy didn't want to have a fleet of one-off designs, they simply divided 69,000 tons by various hull numbers, which yielded mostly three choices. Three ships at 23,000 tons, four ships at 17,250 tons, or five ships at 13,800 tons. There were also a couple of outside field choices. A pair of 27,000-ton ships, which would be bigger and more capable, which would then leave room for a single 17,000-ton design, which was close to the middle option, which would give you four 17,250-ton ships, and a few holdouts who thought you might get away with half a dozen 11,500-ton vessels. Initial work produced half a dozen designs. The baseline consisted of designs 276 and 277. 276 was 23,000 tons, 277 was 27,000 tons. Each design was capable of around about 32 knots and was armed with 8 8-inch guns and a dozen 5-inch guns. The 8-inch armament would be a constant feature of designs in the early part of the 1920s, although whether it was 6, 8 or 9 such weapons varied depending on which design you're looking at. In each case, the hangar was divided into two areas. One area for larger aircraft, i.e. bombers of some description, and one for smaller aircraft, i.e. fighters and possibly reconnaissance types. Sometimes, depending on the design, this could actually be three areas, with large aircraft being held at the fore and aft of the hangar, and the smaller aircraft being held in a slightly shallower part of the hangar amidships, the shallowness caused by the machinery spaces rising up underneath them. The 23,000-ton ship could carry around 60 aircraft, while the 27,000-ton ship could carry around 75 aircraft, as it was estimated that a fighter-sized aircraft occupied around 180 square feet, while a strike aircraft would take up just over 440 square feet, along, of course, with considerations as to hanger width. The next pair of designs were 281 and 282. These were variants on the 27,000-ton vessel. Both dropped speed down to 27 knots and upped the 8-inch armament to 3 triple turrets instead of 4 twins, but they represented two different extremes. For design 281, as well as the small machinery spaces, the belt armour, 3 inches thick on earlier designs, was reduced to 2 inches, and a double hangar was installed, which had theoretical capacity for 105 to 110 aircraft, most of them large, and the air group could be even bigger if a more sane number of fighters happened to be carried. 282, meanwhile, went the other way, with extensive armour, an 8-inch thick belt, and a 2.5-inch thick deck covered large areas of the ship, although it must be noted that this was an internal armoured deck, not an armoured flight deck. This resulted in an air group that was still 85 strong, thanks to the reduction in space taken up by the machinery, which bought back some space that was sacrificed to armour. The 11,500-ton design 286 followed on, with between 24 and 64 aircraft, depending on if you went all in on bombers or all in on fighters. And finally, design 293, at 17,000 tons, offered around about 75 aircraft. In both of the latter cases, the ship's speed was only predicted to be about 28 knots, so again, having smaller machinery spaces allowed proportionally more aircraft to be carried. On this basis, the US Navy concluded that the 27,000-ton hull was the only viable option, as it was the only one that offered at least 75 aircraft and either speed or protection. All the other designs either lacked in air group, or they managed to have the needed air group at the expense of both speed and protection. Of course, having to squeeze a heavy cruiser gun battery into all of this really wasn't helping matters. Since adopting the 27,000-ton hull would only leave the US Navy with 4 large carriers and maybe one smaller one of considerably less value, the schemes were parked until 1924, when the possibility of getting funding to build something made everybody revisit their plans. At this point, there were 2 camps, an entirely aviation-focused camp that wanted a flush-decker with no heavy guns that relied on speed and aircraft to keep itself safe, and another faction that wanted a slower vessel with guns and armour, allowing it to protect itself from enemy cruisers, but which would necessarily have a smaller air group. On the latter design, there was less resistance from pilots to having an island compared to the former one. There was also a subsidiary argument that was being had related to speed. Well above 30 knots, 32.5 knots to be precise, was desired because this, it was thought, would allow the carrier to outrun enemy cruisers. But some argued that, well, if carriers instead operated close to the battle line, which could then protect them from the cruisers, and they just operated on the unengaged side of the battle line, which also then provided a physical barrier to enemy cruisers, then 27 knots would give the carrier enough of a speed margin to take station and catch up with the fleet if they had to break away for air operations due to an unfortunate wind direction. And if you went with that lower speed, it opened up smaller designs to having the requisite air group thanks to reduction in machinery space, and thus you could have more hulls. In later fleet problems, it was actually discovered that this approach would be pretty much suicidal if the carrier didn't have an armoured flight deck, as finding an entire fleet was a, relatively speaking, easy task compared to finding a single ship and a handful of escorts. And that meant that a carrier that operated very close to the fleet would usually be found and hit by enemy aircraft before it could return the favour. But in the mid-1920s, since they didn't have Lexington or Saratoga in the fleet to exercise with, this wasn't something that was known at the time. Not helping matters was the discovery that some of the more heavily armed and armoured ideas actually ended up having larger air groups than the lightly protected and faster designs due to the significant differences in the size of the machinery spaces and the continued requirement for 8-inch guns, particularly on those lightly protected and faster designs, which then took up considerable room. However, The failure of the spending bill in question meant that carrier design went to the back of the priority queue again for a couple of years, and once they resumed carrier designing once more, the tone had changed yet again. It had been pointed out that even the most heavily protected of the earlier designs were still using a conventional armour layout, i.e. a belt and a deck just above it, which protected the ship's machinery and magazines. It didn't protect the hangars, and thus a protected carrier might still physically be there after being subjected to shellfire, but her aviation section was no more protected than that on an essentially unprotected carrier. And so, both heavy armour and the 8-inch battery were actually let go for a while, with smaller designs considered with either minimal protection against destroyers, or in some cases none at all, and a gun armament that maxed out at 6-inch calibre, and in some cases managed to max out with either just 5-inch anti-aircraft guns, or in one case, just 37mm anti-aircraft guns, as the largest weapons aboard. The next restriction that was put in place for the designs was the idea of using a bomber with a 10,000-pound takeoff weight. That necessitated having at least a 13,000-ton carrier, just to get the right flight deck size, and that put an end to a brief flirtation with 10,000-ton carriers, which had cropped up once more. And finally, if it was going to be accepted that carriers were going to have minimal protection, it followed that they would be vulnerable. If they were going to be vulnerable, it was then held that it was better to have many, so that the loss of some wouldn't completely strip the fleet of air support, and that meant sticking with smaller hulls. It was further decided that an ideal air group at this stage should have a 2-to-1 fighter-to-bomber ratio, and by 1927, it was thought that a lightly protected and aviation-focused 13,000 to 14,000-ton carrier would be able to operate no less than 108 aircraft, 36 bombers and 72 fighters, if speed was allowed to drop to 29 knots to expand the hangar bay. This would drop to a mere 81 aircraft, 27 bombers and 54 fighters, if a speed of 32.5 knots was insisted upon instead. But there was also a little bit of a civil war going on among pilots, represented by the Bureau of Aeronautics. Most still wanted a flush deck carrier for easier aircraft handling and because there was no risk of hitting an island if there wasn't an island on the ship, as well as obviously a flush deck carrier offering less disturbed air, at least in theory. But a small group were arguing that, in Royal Navy experience, between the various early British carriers, it had been shown that getting rid of smoke from a flush deck design, which also caused air disturbances as well as more obvious visual issues, was much, much harder with flush deck vessels, and the island, as well as providing a useful place to put the funnel, was a very useful point of reference on approaches, which minimised crashes in the first place, thus somewhat negating the problem of potentially flying into the island. At higher levels, there was also somewhat of an argument still ongoing over speed. More aircraft were obviously good, but other officers valued the ability to operate alongside the faster cruisers that were coming into the fleet, and the latter obviously still wanted the 32.5 knots of speed. Since the Lexingtons were still only just about to commission at this point, and thus there was no practical experience operating the large carriers yet, it was thought that carriers might operate with a destroyer escort to give them protection against submarine attack, rather than a cruiser escort to give them protection against surface attack. Since it was already well known that destroyers would be limited in speed by sea states in the open ocean, the slower 13,800-ton carrier, which could carry more aircraft and which could be built in numbers, became a default choice from which everything else was assessed. And four options in this vein were devised, along with a few smaller and larger ideas for flavouring, but the four 13,800 designs were the main ones taken seriously. They varied in speed and deck layout, and one of them even had a double flight deck. Oddly enough, the pilot faction that wanted a flush deck actually also began to favour the slower designs, as these needed fewer boilers, and thus they produced less smoke, which might then be more easily dealt with by methods that didn't require an island, whereas faster ships, with more boilers, by this point were understood to require at least a small island, which, as we've seen, most pilots were heavily against. A mixed 6-inch anti-surface and 5-inch anti-aircraft battery was still being pushed forward, but then came the advent of the Great Depression, which led to a series of economy measures, including the removal of torpedo bombing capacity entirely, as well as a reduction in the anti-aircraft battery. Cross-deck catapults, which had been called for on the hangar level to launch fighters, were also dropped, which left the ship with an open hangar, which had been designed to operate the catapults, except it seemingly now had no purpose, as the ability to warm up aircraft in an open hangar before bringing them up to the flight deck was not yet really that appreciated. And then early experience with the Lexingtons showed that, in fact, there were quite significant benefits to having an island, and so the whole design had to be changed at the very last minute from a flush deck to having a small island, but it was far too late to move the funnels there, and so they stayed aft as pivoting structures. The open hangar also meant that the anti-aircraft machine guns, rather than being mounted in sponsons on the side of the hull, had to be mounted in gun galleries either side of the flight deck. Thus, another feature that would become very common in later US carriers appeared largely by accident. With Ranger now under construction, more information was becoming available from the operation of Lexington and Saratoga in various fleet problems. The ability of the large carriers to operate far more stably in general weather and at all in rougher weather, combined with a degree of cold feet over just how much protection had been left out of Ranger, gave considerable ammunition to those who advocated for larger carriers going forwards. And so the Navy started looking at 18,500-ton designs, which could take speed back up to over 32 knots and include at least some protection against incoming fire while retaining a useful air group. They also wanted to increase the anti-aircraft battery, reintroduce torpedo bombers, have a proper island, and at least at first even have a double flight deck. This was a huge amount to ask on barely 4,000 tons more than poor old Ranger, and even at the next size increment up, just under 21,000 tons, it would be quite difficult. Still, there was a brief foray into the idea of not only all of this, but also bringing back 8-inch guns. Mercifully, this was a relatively short thought exercise for the most part. Again, thanks to data from the fleet problems with the Lexingtons, high-speed raids were now added to the list of carrier tasks. Now, this wasn't something that Ranger could do. Her limited top speed meant that she was seen as a battle line support carrier only, but it lent far more weight to those who wanted to have the 32.5-knot carrier back on the board. The next issue to resolve was protection. How much of it and where should it go? It was definitely coming back, but exactly where on the ship was still a wide open issue. In exercises, the fact that just two bombs landing on the flight deck were held to remove a carrier's entire operational capability, and but a single bomb could leave you with the ability to recover aircraft but not launch them, had been a major frustration for many carrier captains. And so some officers, noting that carriers had been damaged or destroyed in these exercises far more by incoming aircraft than by incoming ships, advocated for the returning armour to be put on the flight deck, reasoning that even if this meant smaller air groups, an air group that continued to be available throughout an engagement was far more useful than a considerably larger air group that was just trapped in its hangar thanks to a single lucky bomb hit. The argument for a double flight deck, on the other hand, was that it meant that you could get a lot of aircraft off quickly by launching from two flight decks instead of one, and then you could continue air operations using the lower flight deck while the upper flight deck was free for recovering aircraft. But the issues reportedly faced by the British and Japanese carriers that already had these arrangements lent more weight to the other side of the argument, which called for more and better, i.e. faster, aircraft elevators to be combined with cross-deck hangar catapults, which allowed a degree of fighter launch capability while aircraft were landing above, and between them, in theory, this would give most of the advantages of a double flight deck carrier, with virtually none of the drawbacks. The advent of the dive bomber, along with the torpedo bomber and the level bomber, meant that the anti-aircraft battery also had to expand to include long-range heavy anti-aircraft guns and short-range lighter anti-aircraft guns. Attempts to fit the desired upgrades into a Ranger-sized hull met with predictable failure, although some sanity won out in terms of the expected air group. Theoretically, both the Lexingtons and Ranger could operate well over 100 aircraft if they were at maximum capacity. But in exercises, 50 to 60 were more typically operated, even on Lexington and Saratoga, thanks to limitations on space on the flight deck and how long it took to actually get aircraft up there, with the other aircraft in the air group just acting as reserves in case of losses. This fact took some of the pressure off of designers who up until this point had been trying to make the new carriers at least theoretically capable of supporting a similar 100-plus strong air group. A total of 15 designs were now prepared in the early 1930s, most of which looked at ships of between 14,000 or 20 to 21,000 tons, although there were a few larger and a couple of intermediate designs also considered. Although there was quite a promising armoured flight deck design with a 74-strong air group among the approximately 21,000-ton tranche of designs, the siren call of even more aircraft eventually would lead to the adoption of a 20,000-ton design with a theoretical 90-strong air group, mostly because this slight reduction in displacement meant that a just over 15,000-ton design could be built alongside two of the 20,000-ton ships. This smaller design would have a theoretical aircraft capacity of 70 and still retain high speed, but at the cost of some of the protection. These designs would become, of course, Yorktown and Enterprise, and Wasp, respectively, with a good deal of weight still devoted on the Yorktowns to armour protection, but not against bombs as much as against incoming shellfire, since this still dominated the minds of many of the admirals. And with that, of course, interwar US Navy carrier design came to an end. Following the collapse of the treaty system, while a modified Yorktown design carrier in the shape of USS Hornet was constructed, simply because it was far quicker to build something to a pre-existing design than come up with something entirely new, the next real tranche of designs would be the Essex class, the first US carriers unrestrained by any treaty restrictions, and therefore subject, of course, to their own video at some point.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.